This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. The United States is often called a Puritan nation. It's a shorthand way of saying we're a society filled with repressed, austere killjoys. But that's too limiting, says author and humorist Sarah Vowell. In her new book, The Wordy Shipmates, Vowell takes us into the lives of the Puritans. It's a world packed with heresy, exile, quotable sermons, and punctuated with colorful characters. Think John Winthrop and Anne Hutchinson. Okay, so maybe you don't remember who they are, but Vowell will remind you and tell us what makes them so fascinating. If you want to talk with Sarah Vowell, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, or send an email to talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog. That is at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the hour, the lowdown on the Dow. What does it mean to you? But first, a witty look back on that city on a hill. Joining us now is Sarah Vowell. Her book is called The Wordy Shipmates. She joins us now from our bureau in New York. Good to have you with us.
Thanks.
Now, I suspect that a lot of listeners who may know you from This American Life would be surprised to discover that you really are quite a historian. Is this a new love of yours?
I don't think of myself as an historian. I just think of myself as a writer. And I still just write about history as a journalist. You know, I set out to just find out about things and then go forward. I'm not any kind of expert. So I think maybe for that reason, my books can be fairly welcoming to people who think they're not interested in history, which is, you know, I call those people Americans.
But, you know, you're not a slouch. I have to be honest
thanks.
With you. I learned an awful lot, and some of it I think I never learned. Maybe some of it I had forgotten, but a lot of it I think I didn't know in the first place. And I was really surprised by just how much history there really is in there. There's a lot of really, you know, classic Sarah Vowell moments, and there's a lot of funny stuff in here, but I learned an awful lot about the Puritans, but I bet a lot of people are wondering, okay, the Puritans, Sarah Vowell, why? Why the Puritans?
Well, one reason, I think the reason I wanted to do it is probably the reason you were perhaps less informed on the subject is because, you know, what people think of the Puritans, and I specifically write about the founders of the Massachusetts Bay Colony around the Boston area in 1630s, is that they're so intellectual, and I think we sort of think of Puritans as stupid, but they're so brainy and they're so learned that a lot of their writings are kind of dense and hard to get to. And so I feel like I tried to do that for you, understand them, and then, you know, hand over the juicier, more quotable bits from their writing, but it's their writing and their sort of passion for that, for literature and for, you know, books, one book, specifically the Bible, of course, but just the writing is so vivid sometimes, and there's so much of it. They were intensely bookish people, considering their, you know, kind of frontiersmen. It's remarkable, and it's the thing I admire most about them. And, you know, I didn't start out in radio. I started out writing as a critic, and I wrote about books and music mostly, and so this is kind of a return to that route. A lot of what I write about is their writing.
Yeah, which is why they are called wordy shipmates. I have to say, when mm-hmm. I first saw that, I thought they were all very talkative people or something.
Well, they are. They cannot shut up, and some of them more than others, and some of them get kicked out of Massachusetts for their talking.
Well, I have to go right to the first point you made, which is that you are talking about the Puritans from the Massachusetts Bay Colony in the 1630s. Right from the start, I have to admit that I didn't realize the distinctions there were between the Plymouth Puritans and the Massachusetts Bay Colony Puritans and mm-hmm. things like that. Would you really go into?
Yeah, well, I think mainly when we learn about 17th century New England in school, it's basically we hear about Plymouth and Thanksgiving, and then maybe there's a pit stop at the Salem witch trials and then move on. But in the middle bits are actually, I think, with the Bay Colony and John Winthrop and John Cotton and their shipmates, I think that's sort of the most crucial our most crucial inheritance as Americans sort of comes from their ideas of themselves as chosen by God, and the idea of the city on a hill. I think not to downplay the importance of Thanksgiving, but I think knowing about Winthrop and his people is we are them in a lot of ways.
Well, let's just talk about that whole idea of a city on a hill, because that was a phrase from one of Winthrop's sermons, which we have heard over and over again in different forms in modern speeches. Tell us a little bit about what
we've heard that one phrase, but it comes at the end of a fairly long sermon, mm-hmm. To me, the sermon, it's really quite beautiful, and it's the context of it is, we don't know specifically when Winthrop gave it, either back on the shore in England as the colonists were about to set sail, or maybe on out on the open sea. But my point being, that sermon was it was delivered at the very beginning, before the colonists even arrived in New England. And I was just rereading it, a little bit of it again this morning, and thinking about, in the context of leadership, and these people were on the verge of a pretty scary future, and they don't know what's coming, and they don't even know if they'll live through the sea voyage. And Winthrop is telling them, this is going to be hard, and we are going to have to stick together, and we should be knit together in this work as one man, and rejoice together and mourn together and suffer together, and as if we're members of the same body. He's saying we're one person. We should be one person in this endeavor. And that is our work, and we will be the city on a hill, and people are watching us, not just to look up to us, but also perhaps to see us fail. And so it's this very stirring, sermon about solidarity and community. That I think when, the phrase is just the city on the hill, the soundbite, when it's just, thrown out there like it was the other night in the vice presidential debate, Sarah Palin threw it out. It's just as shorthand that everyone should look up to us. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't exactly what Winthrop meant entirely. He thought everyone could look up to us, but he also thought we are special, we are blessed, we have this enormous responsibility, and if we fail, everyone will see us fail. And I think sometimes in America, we might understand that part of it.
But something that was really interesting about your own, the personal connections you made with that sermon came at the time of 9/11 and the sense of community that you felt occurred in New York at that time. Sort of that sermon, I guess, kind of resonated in your head at that time.
Yeah, it was just one of the things I read to, just as kind of solace, that part, the rejoicing and suffering together as members of the same body. And I would turn to that sermon in those days because, for one thing, living in New York, besides the, actual just grief, the air quality was so poor, and partly that was because of the incinerated steel and building materials from the World Trade Center, but it was also our incinerated fellow citizens. We were breathing them, and that was horrifying. But also on the ground in Manhattan at that time, and it was so beautiful, really. And there was a sense of this kind of communal love, and people look you in the eye on the sidewalk and say hello, it was not a happy time, but a really meaningful time because of that sense of community in a time of crisis.
So when you read that and you make the connections, do you think there really is like a direct connection in the sort of in who we are as Americans to this group of people who brought over those kinds of notions, who brought those kinds of notions with them when they created the colony?
I definitely think there's a direct connection to their idea of themselves as God's new chosen people. I think we're not always good at solidarity in this country, you know. I mean, I talk about, I came of age in the Reagan era, and I spend a bit of the book talking about the way President Reagan would, you know, bandy about that phrase and about being a city on a hill. And to me, my interpretation...
And he called it a shining city on the hill.
Yes, he liked to sparkle things up a little bit. He was a little, still a little bit of a showman there. Like, to me, the sermon is it's called A Model of Christian Charity, and it's about charity and generosity and communal welfare, basically, which, you know, wasn't really President Reagan's strong suit. I mean, he could quote the City on the Hill bit, and then, you know, Winthrop, and then go and cut the budget for housing and urban developments, you know, sending, you know, thousands of people out of their homes and things like that. So part of it, there's like a true Christianity, like, and I mean the kind of radical revolutionary Sermon on the Mount sort of Christianity. And in fact, Winthrop gets the image of the city on a hill from Jesus, from the book of Matthew. And there's, I don't even know where I'm going with all of this. I'm just saying, I think in this country, yes, there's a definite direct connection from our idea of ourselves as, you know, the most blessed chosen nation on earth.
The whole idea of American exceptionalism, I think you say, really,
yes,
they brought
exactly
with them.
Yeah.
But the which thing still lives very much today.
Very much, very much. Yes, we are still the greatest USA, USA. But the thing that the Puritans had, they were like hardcore Calvinists, you know, and they had this sense of wrath and fear of failure and failing their God. And there was a real kind of constant questioning going on, you know, are they failing their God? And they would do things like have a day of fast, like, oh, we're failing our God, we can't eat today. And I think America has sort of lost a little bit of that, the sense of, like, fear of failure and responsibility.
All right, we're going to continue this discussion with Sarah Vowell, the author of the new book, The Wordy Shipmates. And if you'd like to talk with Sarah Vowell or have any questions for her, give us a call at 800-989-8255. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. They wear little in the way of colorful clothing, but be assured the Puritans were anything but staid. We're talking with Sarah Vowell about her new book on those vibrant ancestors of ours. It's called Wordy Shipmates. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we're going to take a call now from Paul, and he is calling from Whiteville, North Carolina. Hi, Paul.
Hi. This is a question for Sarah or Lynn. You had mentioned the Puritan experiment as rejoicing and suffering together as members of the same body. I should like to add that perhaps from a Puritan perspective, as long as that body is male and not female. My question has to do with Anne Hutchinson, if you wouldn't mind, Sarah, talking about that a bit. Namely, would you see Anne Hutchinson as the Joan of Arc of early colonial America? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Thanks for that, because the book talks quite a bit about Anne Hutchinson, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. The Joan of Arc, I don't know. You know, I mean, I set up the whole Winthrop sermon, City on a Hill thing, and you know, and talk about my love for this beautiful idea of being members of the same body. But then I also say, like, those words were spoken before they even got here and had to, and Winthrop actually had to govern. And it turned out that there were a lot of, you know, mouthy rabble-rousers who lived amongst these Puritans, and they needed to be sort of clipped from the body like a toenail, and just, you know, the troublemakers. And Anne Hutchinson was certainly one of those, and she was this woman. I kind of call her the Puritan Oprah, because she... She's,
that's better than Joan of Arc, I think.
She probably things turn out better. Well, So Anne Hutchinson, she was a minister's daughter, and she was a mother, a very fertile woman, had, you know, I think 15 children, comes over here with her husband, who's very wealthy. They're kind of like the richest people in Boston, basically. And she's also a midwife. And so she meets a lot of women in Boston very quickly because she's, you know, helping them deliver their babies. And she starts having them over to her house, too. At first to talk about that Sunday sermon, but then she starts basically delivering her own sermons in her home, and dozens of people, including a lot of men, start coming to hear her essentially preach. And this is, and her followers start questioning the other ministers in the colony and heckling them in their churches. And so she goes on trial. She's basically causing so much trouble. She needs to be removed. And she basically outwits all of them, including Winthrop in her trial. She makes them, you know, say what law she has broken. And, you know, they can't think of anything to say other than you're driving us nuts, essentially. But she's about to be acquitted. But then one person stands up and kind of digs her grave. And that person is Anne Hutchinson, because Anne Hutchinson finally, she has the floor and she loves the sound of her own voice and she cannot shut up. And so she starts, you know, expounding all of her eccentric religious beliefs. She believes she's filled with the Holy Spirit and this is just blasphemy to the Puritans. And so they kick her out, and like Roger Williams, she goes to Rhode Island, and Rhode Island kind of becomes the refuge and where all kinds of people, not just, you know, Puritan heretics, but Baptists and Quakers and Jews come to live in relative religious freedom. She's an interesting figure, definitely.
And you just mentioned Roger Williams, and I mean, this was really interesting, Roger Williams' role in sort of just, you know, the early sort of underpinnings of the idea of separation of church and state.
Right. He wants there to be a wall of separation. He uses those words, you know, way before Jefferson, but he wants there to be separation between the two because he doesn't want the state muddying up his church. He's incredibly idealistic about his religion, and he's a very sort of, in a lot of ways, eccentric person and kind of clownish sometimes, and he's terribly annoying and won't shut up, but he's also a pretty remarkable thinker, and he believes one of the tenets of you know, Christianity is thou shalt not kill, and he doesn't like state-sponsored religion because it gets all muddied up with state-sponsored violence. And he wants everyone to be able to worship how they see fit or not worship, because he's kind of focused on the fact that everyone, all the other sinners, the ones who don't believe as he does, they'll be punished in the afterlife in the eternal flames of hell. So that's kind of enough punishment for him. So he wants everyone, you know, to live side by side and believe or not believe whatever they want. He just wants them to constantly argue about it, which I find to be an incredibly enlightened sort of religious fanatic, you know.
That they're willing to argue the points, yeah.
Yeah, he does, even as an old man, he gets in his canoe and goes to Newport to argue with some Quakers who he thinks is nuts, but he doesn't want them banished from Rhode Island. He's happy that they're living there. He just thinks they're wrong, and he wants to tell them that.
Okay. Let's take another call. We're going to go to Kyle calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Kyle.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if Sarah, in examining Puritan culture, could see any significant influences from the Native nations they encountered, any long-lasting reactions on Puritan thought, for example. Did it reinforce or disrupt Puritan values?
Well, the Roger Williams story is really interesting in terms of that interaction, because when he gets banished from Massachusetts, the Narragansett take him in, and he ends up writing this dictionary, an English Algonquin dictionary that's kind of a glossary of terms from the Algonquin languages. But it's also this remarkable book. In between the glossary, he talks about Native culture, and it's sort of it, all of the words that he knows because of how welcoming they were to him. So a lot of his vocabulary is all about being welcomed and offered food. And, you know, even when he describes things like canoeing, he talks about how, you know, some of the Narragansett, you know, they tell him, don't be afraid. If you fall out of your canoe, we'll help you. We'll pull you out. And the way he describes it, you know, and he talks about the Narragansett and how, like, they, if someone gets something, everyone shares. And if someone goes through some kind of trial, everyone is sad. And in a strange way, the way he describes Narragansett culture, it's almost like they're living out those ideals of Winthrop, of rejoicing and suffering together, except for, you know, the Jesus part, which Roger Williams is horrified by Native religious ceremonies. But he actually has a bone to pick with the English who kicked him out and ruined his life and took his house and, you know, and sent him on the run. And he's rather charming when he's talking about, especially when he's comparing the Narragansett to the English who, you know, he just thinks were, yeah, a little too judgmental.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
I have an email here, and that email is from Robin from Jacksonville, Florida. What were their views on the economy, profit, and personal wealth? I think somebody might want you to be making some pronouncements about the current state of the world.
Oh, but, no. Relevance. Interesting. Why would you be thinking about that? Let's see. I do know that Winthrop believed that, I mean, actually, a model of Christian charity, to be quite honest, the very first part of it is about how God has decided some people will be rich and some people will be poor. Like, that's his opener. Uh-huh. And you know, and some people will lead and some people will follow. And, you know, he's the governor, so we know who he is. But the basic start of it is God has decided what kind of life you'll have. And some of you are not going to be rich. So there's that. And so everyone's station in life and their afterlife is all predetermined by God. So there's that. But Winthrop also believed, especially when they were starting the colony, when they were first building everything, some people obviously did have more means than others. And Winthrop was governor, and his deputy governor was kind of a little bit of a bee in his bonnet, and those two didn't often agree. And Winthrop caused this whole fracas in the colony because the other guy, Winthrop's sort of nemesis, built this ostentatious house with this ostentatious wainscoting. Mm-hmm. And Winthrop is appalled about this wainscoting, thinking, you know, that this guy is being too showy. And it's like in the beginning of a plantation, we need to, you know, we need to tone all that down. And so there's that. And he also berates the man because he overcharged some poor people for some grain, I believe. So, you know, I think the Puritans are just like any other sort of people. There are some that are a little more profit-oriented and others who aren't. But, like, I'm talking about the 1630s. I mean, later in the century, I don't really get into that, but once things become much more mercantile and there are all these, you know, there are all kinds of books about Salem and the witch trial era, which I don't really talk about, but where, you know, there's New England merchants and the seafaring and fishing and all that brings so much more money into the colony that economics becomes, you know, a bigger controversy. In the beginning, it's basically trying not to die.
All right, let's take a call now from Dean in Idaho Falls, Idaho. Hi, Dean.
Hi. It's, this is spinning my world around because I always had Winthrop in that group of sinners in the hands of an angry God style preachers. And you're describing a much warmer and fuzzier John Winthrop. Was I just off my nut?
Well, I actually think the sinners in the hands of the angry God. That's Jonathan Edwards,
right?
Who's the he's a century later, and that's actually a much more touchy feely in a way sort of Christianity. It's much more ecstatic and fire and brimstone like that. Winthrop is his their form of Christianity is incredibly, you know, disciplined and guilt-ridden. I mean, what religion isn't guilt-ridden? Maybe there are some, I don't know. But no, he's in fact, they talk about, like, what you're talking about, Jonathan Edwards, is that's part of the Great Awakening, which came later, which was a much more emotional form of Christianity. And that's actually why one reason Anne Hutchinson gets kicked out, because she's starting to practice that sort of later form of Christianity, the kind that we would probably recognize more closely resembling evangelical fundamentalism, you know, these days. Like, my Puritans, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they're incredibly intellectual, and like I say, there's no speaking in tongues going on in Massachusetts Bay Colony unless you count classical Greek.
I don't think there's any speaking in tongues going on in Massachusetts now either, right?
I wouldn't know. That actually, that's a relatively late development. I think speaking in tongues doesn't come about until maybe the 19th century. I could be wrong. That's off my area. But no, Winthrop is, he's not a touchy-feely guy. And it, I mean, this is, you know, just a like 1 hour radio show. I do kind of go into, he's a totalitarian as well. And so when he becomes governor, and you see how he governs, there are some harsh punishments for people who disagree and who, you know, refuse to, I mean, agreeing to agree is kind of the Puritan orthodoxy, you know, the party line. So anyone who doesn't agree with the magistrates and the ministers, if they're given the opportunity to admit they're wrong and to repent, but if they fail to repent, then there are harsh punishments. One person I describe was a servant who refused to stop bad-mouthing the magistrates and the minister, and Winthrop and his fellow magistrates had the man's ears cut off, and he was banished. Wow. And
wanted to say, let me just remind our listeners that we're talking with Sarah Vowell about her new book, The Wordy Shipmates, and you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I mean, this does bring us, Sarah, to one point I wanted to make, which is, you know, there's clearly we have been talking about a sort of kinder, gentler Puritan than people may have thought of, but there's also violence. You know, the Puritans could be violence, how did they reconcile that and their treatment of the Indians, the Pequots in particular?
Well, part of their whole you know, to them, God was like all powerful in a way that I think most Protestants nowadays, like, I was raised evangelical, and a lot of the responsibility, say, for my own salvation was my own. But the Puritans in Massachusetts, they're Calvinists, and they believe that God is all powerful, and everything that happens is because God wants it to happen. And so there's a lot of like circular logic. One, like with the Pequot in the Pequot War, it's a horrifying moment. And they end up engaged in this, you know, war, and they set a Pequot village on fire, and 700 men, women, and children are burned alive. And the writing that some of the New England militia captains, they write afterward, it's kind of horrifying, because they see the very fact that God allowed these people to be burned alive as justification and as a cause for celebration. When that militia comes back to Boston has a day of Thanksgiving to celebrate this victory. So they see themselves as God blessed and God chosen, and this was just a justifiable God blessed act that just reinforces their own superiority.
All right, let's see if we can get one more call in here. Elizabeth from Tucson, Arizona. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Hi. I just wanted to ask Sarah if she had ever considered becoming a history teacher. I'm a teacher myself, and I have never heard anyone describe American history, especially the periods in which you've written about and are describing now, in such a vivid and juicy way.
Well, read the book, because it's pretty juicy, too.
Thanks. I could never really become a teacher as a, you know, full job, because I don't really like talking to people. I mean, I like talking to people, but I like being a writer and being alone in my apartment for months at a time, figuring things out. The whole being around a lot of people all day long, I couldn't really handle that. So my book is, I guess, my way of reaching people.
I absolutely understand that, but I want to thank you for your contribution. I also want to add that I loved you in The Incredible.
Oh, thanks.
All right, thanks.
All right, thanks so much for calling, Elizabeth. Well, there you go. You have a new option now in your career path, Sarah.
Yeah, maybe if this writer thing goes south, I'll think about it.
It can always be a teacher. Thanks so much for joining us today, Sarah.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Sarah Val is the author of the new book, The Wordy Shipmate. I'm Lynn Neary, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now, does the Dow matter? Many of us watched in horror as the stock market plummeted more than 800 points yesterday. By the end of the day, it gained much of that back, just to drop another 300 points this afternoon, leaving some of us scratching our heads wondering what was all that about. The Dow Jones Industrial Average today is still below 10,000, currently about 9,600. And though experts advise us not to pay too much attention to the Dow, it is hard to ignore when your life savings are tied up in the stock market. So what exactly does the Dow mean? Do you pay attention to the Dow? What does it tell you? And if not, is there some other indicator that you watch instead? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. Seth Jason is guilty of watching the Dow often, I'm sure. He's a senior analyst at The Motley Fool and joins us from a studio there. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So, Seth, sometimes we hear experts say the Dow doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. Why? Why doesn't it matter?
Well, I'm going to, since it's election season, in the spirit of election season, I'm going to say that it matters and it doesn't matter all at the same time. It doesn't matter by some people's estimation simply because it's kind of an old-fashioned and strange index. It's price-weighted, which means that if something drops a buck, it has the same effect on the index. Even if that stock is worth $10, which would represent, of course, a 10% drop for that particular stock, or if it's a $100 stock, which would be a much smaller percentage drop for that stock were it in the index. It's also kind of a strange index because they, in order to account for dividends and splits over the years, they've had to come up with a Dow divisor. So it's really kind of hard to keep track on exactly what the Dow means. It's probably best for most investors to look at a market cap weighted index like the S&P 500. Which also has the advantage of being a much broader index, 500 large companies instead of just 30 companies, which are really picked arbitrarily by the folks over at the Wall Street Journal.
But these wild fluctuations that we've been seeing, they tell us something, don't they?
Yeah, well, they tell us a lot more right now. Now, the Dow itself is funky. If we look at all of these indexes together and what's going on in the markets, they're all flipping up and down 3%, 4%, 5% or more intraday these days. And what that is telling us right now is that people are really in panic mode. So we're stepping really away from the academic argument of what the Dow index itself means into what the fluctuation in the equities markets means. And that's really pretty difficult to get our hands on. I believe now we're here at the Motley Fool. We're really pretty optimistic in the long run. We like to pick individual stocks. But where we are right now, I believe, is in the place where we start to get into the vicious cycle where psychology actually does start to undermine the economy as a whole. And we're seeing evidence of that in many places. And today, most notably, we're seeing it when the Fed came out and said that it would start buying a lot of short-term debt, sometimes called commercial paper, in order to keep credit markets moving in the U.S. and to keep companies like AT&T, who couldn't get people to buy, or the usual suspects, to buy their one-week IOUs in order to keep funding moving so that they could actually run the business.
Can you explain that to me, by the way, while we're on the subject of the is it the paper credits, is that?
They call it commercial paper, but I'm by no means a debt market expert. But what this really means is there are a lot of companies out there who don't always have the cash on hand to pay the bills, to buy the inventory, to pay employees, things like that. And so what they do and what they need to be able to do because of how they've built their businesses over the years is be able to issue debt for short periods of time, a week, month, 2 months. And some companies have found, and I read a story that AT&T was among them, that people just aren't willing to buy this debt for even short periods, which is why the Fed is stepping in and buying a lot of it, because they realize that if people won't buy that debt and you start seeing layoffs, you start seeing people unable to build inventories or do the things they need to do to run the businesses, then the perception and the fear actually become the reality, and the economy as a whole suffers real damage based on the perceived damage that people are afraid will be coming up.
Why is it called commercial paper? I don't really understand what that is.
Well, there's probably a long and a long history and a better explanation than I can give you, but basically it's paper. You're issuing IOUs to people and you're doing it for commercial purposes, and it's actually distinct from other kinds of debt under SEC rules. And so that's probably a topic that's more complex than we want to get into. But the takeaway for the average listener right now is that what the Fed is doing today by announcing this really pretty large commercial paper buying program is recognizing that the IOUs of American businesses are not being accepted, are not being taken, are not being purchased by the usual entities that used to buy them, which were pension funds and money market funds and others. And so somebody needs to step up and do that. Otherwise, these businesses will really freeze up. So really what we're seeing now is an issue that's separate from the bailout we just had, but one that is probably even more important for the short term.
All right, let's take a call. We're going to go to, I think it's Morris in Columbus, Ohio.
Hi.
Hi, is it Maurice? Or?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
I work for a nationwide transportation company. I drive a truck, and on an average week, I see about 50 different customers. And we seem to have a pretty good indicator of when times are good or times are bad by the amount of freight that they're putting on our truck. And what we've seen recently is our tonnage levels are down 20%. This year, year to date from last year. And regardless of what the market does, if people aren't, you know, if they're nervous and not buying, people don't manufacture, it's going to have a negative effect.
That's interesting. What do you think about that, Seth, that as an indicator of where we're going economically?
I think that's a very good indicator, and it's something that the average person who's invested in the market, really whether they like it or not, most people are. If they have a pension plan or any kind of 401k or 403b, they're in the market in some way or another. And there are ways, you know, people like the caller have insight into the economy that others may not, and looking at the amount of freight that's out there is one. I've been reading over the past few weeks about the drop in freight coming into ports like Long Beach, and that this was an indicator, a leading indicator, that that American retailers were expecting to sell less because they're bringing in fewer items to sell. And so you could sort of see this happening. And of course, as I said in the beginning, the position we're in now is we're entering that vicious cycle where perceptions become reality as people fear things will get bad. They do things that make things a little worse, and then it feeds into itself and just keeps going that way. And that's what the policymakers in the country are really afraid of right now. And this is why they're rushing to sort of pour water on every little fire they see.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Maurice.
Okay. Thank you.
Interesting point. All right. We're going to go to Curtis, and he's calling from Salem, Oregon. Hi, Curtis.
Yes, hello. I really feel there's a problem we have is we mistake the economy, or stock market, for the real economy, which is buying research and development, plant and equipment. And basically, it's much more akin to a bookie operation and or fantasy football. It doesn't have a whole lot of real connection to true football. Anyway, that's my feeling.
All right, that just seems like a big fantasy football game to you. I had a 12-year-old ask me, you know, one day last week, who controls the stock market and why can't they just, you know, make the numbers go up?
You know,
part of me didn't really know how to answer that question, I have to say.
Well, the folks in charge have tried that. They've tried to restrict short selling on hundreds now of companies to at least reduce the selling pressure on them. And I think the point that our caller Curtis makes about the conflation, especially in the media, of the stock market and the economy is a very, very important one. And I have tried to make it many times here at The Motley Fool in my writing, which is that these are two distinct things. An economy can be doing very poorly while the stock market goes up. In fact, stock markets tend to sort of get up and out of the doldrums long before the economies do when you look back at history. But conversely, I mean, the stock market was really roaring along late last year, and I was very skeptical at that time. In a lot of my writing, I was warning people especially to stay away from banks because I could see what was coming up, not with perfect clarity, by the way. I'm not trying to say that I could see onto those balance sheets, but what I was warning people is that things just didn't seem to me as great as everybody said at the time when the market was roaring. And so, you know, the stock market and the economy are often really disconnected from each other, and that's a really important point. When the market is down, it doesn't mean the economy is down. And when the market is up, it doesn't mean our economic footing is great.
Yeah, but what's happening now mean in terms of the economy?
Well, that's the problem right now, as I'm saying, with this vicious cycle, because there are some obvious interconnections between how stock prices work and the business of being in business. For instance, if you need to go out and raise capital and your stock price has been absolutely hammered because of market pessimism, then of course you can't really raise capital as easily. And this is something that a lot of banks and other financials out there have found out to their chagrin. And actually, you know, some of them couldn't make a go of it because they absolutely could not raise capital by issuing stock. And we've seen some of them go bankrupt. Some of them have had to have been taken over by the government. So,
you know, you were saying before that, you know, mostly anybody with a pension plan or 401k does have something in the stock market. And given the drops and certainly the ups and downs we've been seeing, a lot of people are moving away from stocks in their retirement accounts. Does that make sense to you? Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, the decision to get out of stocks or more volatile investments like the equities, the stocks we're talking about now, is unfortunately one that should have been made a while ago for folks who have a shorter time frame. Now, over longer time periods, the stock market has tended in the past to always outperform a lot of other investment assets that you can really easily get a hold of. And so our advice at The Motley Fool, where we're all individual investors, basically, we're just like everybody else out there, has been that, you know, if you need money or suspect you'll need money within the next 5 years, that is money that you should never have in the stock market, because the market does go through periods like this, and you do not want to have to sell the furniture or burn the furniture in order to heat the house, as they say. So unfortunately, right now is the worst time to be selling because everything is down. If you need that money, you know, to pay the rent or something, you're sort of stuck. The other issue to look at a period like this is that psychology right now in the markets is absolutely awful. And history has always shown that these down markets, people tend to dump and everybody gets out. And in fact, that's why the markets just keep going down until they start to flatline. And this is something that behavioral psychologists and others have done a lot of work on. And if anybody needs a way to get their mind off what's going on in the market and learn a little bit about this, I'd like to recommend they take a look at a couple of books. One is called Your Money and Your Brain by Jason Zweig, and another one is called Stumbling on Happiness by Daniel Gilbert. And both of those talk about the psychology of being inside the moment and being scared and not being able to see further ahead in the future, because how you feel about the future is indelibly colored by how you're feeling right now.
All right. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And just I have a really good email here, but it's got a bunch of questions. I'm not sure I'm going to have time to answer all of them. This is from Richard in St. Louis. He says, how about some basics? One, what is actually happening when a sudden large drop in the stock market occurs? Do people simply rush out to sell a bunch of stock every time there's bad news? And who actually sets individual stock prices? Who is the auctioneer who determines whether individual stock prices rise or fall? You know the answer to all those questions?
If only it were that easy. There's no auctioneer that determines whether or not prices are fall. The prices, and it differs from market to market, are set by market makers or specialists who are the sort of go-betweens between the buyers and the sellers. But prices go up and down based on what people are willing to offer that second and what they're willing to pay that second. And one of the questions in there seems to me is a little bit, it's a common misconception that every time a stock price moves that there must be a reason that it moved, that there must be a piece of news that actually made it move. I was looking at a company this morning that I follow, that I own, and it was down 12% yesterday, down about another 6% today, and there's absolutely no news at all that really has any effect on this company that has come out in the past couple of weeks, yet it's probably moved 25-30%. Simply all that's happened is that You know, there's a culture of fear, and prices across the board are moving down as people pull their money out of stocks. And, of course, if everybody is pulling their money out of stocks because they want to put it in the sock drawer or somewhere else, the prices are just going to continue to fall.
All right, let's take one more call. Jay from Denver, Colorado. Hi, Jay.
Hi. You know, that young boy that you had mentioned that asked the question about why not just say some good words to improve the stock market, because it seems like the stock market is almost like an entity unto itself. And when the Fed chairman says three words or, you know, just says boo, it drops. Well, why couldn't they say something else and it goes up? It seems this just goes to what we were talking about, what you were talking about just now, about why that stock that you were holding dropped.
It just seems to be uncontrollable, you're saying. The whole.
Yeah.
Why does it seem to be so uncontrollable, Seth?
Yeah. And if it's a culture of fear, can't that be changed?
Okay. Thanks for your question, Jay.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it can be changed, but it only changes slowly. And the more I've watched the market, especially over the past couple of months, the more I have come to realize that even if you happen to know a piece of news that you think will make the market move one way or the other, you can't even be sure that it will. In other words, if you have to look a little bit at how the market is always trying to parse Fed speak and what Mr. Bernanke might say. Now, if Mr. Bernanke came out as he did today and he says, well, you know, the economy faces even more pressure than I thought. I think we're looking at a longer, deeper downturn. You can look at it two ways. One way you can look at it as an investor is, hey, that means there's a rate cut on the way, which changes all the equations on which we value stocks, and that means stock prices should theoretically go up, and the market could conceivably go up. Today, the markets actually have kept going down. So if you're looking for an answer that's tied to what the Fed chief said, you have to say, well, you know, these companies are going to do even worse because the economy is going to be even worse and things will go down. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's no way to predict exactly how any kind of pronouncement of optimism or even any news, hard news, will be perceived by the market. And so you really can't manage that, and it's probably not the government's place to even try to manage that. The point isn't to try and make stocks go up. It's to just provide a good market and let them set their own prices.
All right, Seth, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Seth Jason is a senior analyst at The Motley Fool. He joined us from a studio at The Fool headquarters in Alexandria, Virginia. Tomorrow, political junkie Ken Rudin and Neil Conan wrap up tonight's presidential debate. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington.